1 year after the deadliest attack against Latinos in recent history, Texas remembers those lost in El Paso during a day of reflection and healing. More today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Democrats beating Republicans in fundraising for Texas congressional races. We'll have a closer look. Also, a battle in Midland before and after a vote to rename a city high school. The storm before the storms, what Hurricane Hanna might add up to for Texas's energy sector, and packets of mystery seeds from China raising concerns. A Texas A&M expert is on the case. Those stories and a whole lot more as the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Monday. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Many Texans will never forget this date. But the third day of August 2019 started out like any other early August Saturday in Texas. Parents and kids were getting ready for school, and in El Paso, a popular Walmart store was bustling with activity at midday as people were getting their shopping done, buying clothes and backpacks, pens and notebooks. Lots of families were getting their weekly shopping done, picking up groceries and other items. Over at El Paso's Coronado High School, Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar was holding a Saturday town hall meeting and was finishing up answering a question about conditions for migrants at the southern border when two people walked up to the front and took the microphone from her and said something to her that the audience couldn't hear. Escobar again took the microphone and said, "You all, I'm sorry," ending the event abruptly at the request of police. The reason? A tragedy unfolding 14 miles away at the Walmart at Cielo Vista Mall. Back at the store, it was pandemonium. Police say a young white man from Allen, Texas, had traveled 600 miles to El Paso with an AK-47, opening fire on shoppers. This, after writing a 2,300-word racist screed on a message board with a reputation as a breeding ground for white supremacy. Prosecutors say the alleged gunman had come to El Paso to target Hispanics. 23 people died in the attack. The alleged shooter, now 22 years old, faces dozens of state and federal charges, including nearly two dozen counts of capital murder at the state level and 23 counts of hate crimes resulting in death. Among those killed, 60-year-old Arturo Benavides, a decorated Army veteran and retired city bus driver. The coronavirus pandemic has altered plans for big collective memorial events, but over the weekend, Benavides' family was able to gather together and remember him. The memorial took place at a dedication ceremony for a transit center near the Walmart that's been renamed in his honor. KERA's Mallory Falk was there.
When she was little, Melissa Tinajero was kind of intimidated by her uncle, who everyone called Turi.
He tried to portray like he was like this tough, strong guy, you know, military, whatever. But deep down, he was just like a super softy.
A doting uncle to his many nieces and nephews, eager to lend a hand, even if it wasn't always appreciated at the time, like when he taught Tinajero how to swim.
He was a lifeguard, and so go out to the pool, and while all the kids were splashing and playing, like, he had me doing laps because he wanted to make sure that I knew how to swim before I could go and have fun.
Benavides was one of eight children and really tight with his family. When the siblings got together, they'd revert back to their childhood selves and gently tease each other. Benavides' brother Mike especially loved messing with him. Here's their sister Yolanda.
When Mike would tease him, he would always say, "Mom, look at Mike. Stop it, Mike. Stop it, Mike." And my brother would tease him on purpose because everybody wanted to hear my brother Turi say that.
But really, I don't know why they say that. I'm quiet. I'm the shy one of the family.
As you might have guessed, that's Mike. Saturday's ceremony was a chance for the family to reminisce as they gathered outside what's now called the Arturo Turi Benavides Eastside Transit Center. It's just across the street from the Walmart where he was killed while shopping with his wife, Patricia. She'd been sitting on a bench to rest her legs as he waited in the checkout line. They got separated when the shooting started, and she made it out alive. Many of the victims, including Benavides, were 60 or older. He'd been enjoying lots of time with Mike as they both entered their golden years.
Me being retired as well, wherever I would go, I'd go pick him up so, you know, he wouldn't be at home by himself. So we hung out a lot.
They listened to music together. Mike says his brother was a disco fanatic.
And then, of course, Spanish as well. He loved Juan Gabriel, Jose Jose.
Driving around, cracking jokes while music poured out of the speakers.
That's going to be missed for a long, long, long time.
The coronavirus pandemic has thwarted plans for large public gatherings to remember those lost 1 year ago. Many memorials are taking place virtually or at a distance, like driving through a park lit up by luminarias at night. But the Benavides family was able to gather for a small, physically distanced ceremony.
Good morning, everyone.
Folding chairs were placed 6 feet apart with a pink carnation on each seat. People wore masks along with memorial t-shirts. Two Sun Metro buses flanked the podium. Their screens flashed bright orange text in memory of Arturo Benavides. The mayor and other city leaders gave speeches and unveiled a memorial plaque that will hang outside the transit center. Patricia Benavides spoke briefly, dressed in a t-shirt with a smiling photo of her husband, framed by angel wings.
This is great. And I'm pretty sure he's watching it. And he's very proud of himself.
Now, passengers waiting for their bus to arrive can read the plaque and learn about her husband, his military service, and 20 dedicated years with Sun Metro. His niece, Melissa Tinajero, says she'll always think of him first as a kind, sensitive, generous person.
And I'm happy that so many people are getting to know who he is. You know, otherwise he would just be another person. I mean, to us, he'd be super special and we know, but now everybody gets to know about him.
Yolanda Tinajero says she's very proud of her brother.
When he lived and now, always proud of him.
I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Events related to our top stories scheduled for this day include a drive-through memorial at a local park in El Paso. Tonight, the city's iconic Star on the Mountain will flash 23 times to honor each of the victims. But even after the day's remembrances and reflections, the tragedy is likely to continue to reverberate politically, as experts note an increase in civic participation since the tragedy. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has more.
Tito Anshondo manages his family's auto body shop in El Paso.
The closer it gets to August, the more of like a sinking feeling that I get, you know, in my chest.
A year ago, Tito's brother Andre and sister-in-law Jordan were at the Walmart Supercenter. They died protecting their baby son Paul from the shooter. President Trump came to El Paso a few days later, leading to massive protests from people who blamed Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric for inspiring the shooter. But Tito Anshondo was grateful his family and baby Paul got to meet the president.
He has a stigma behind him. If he were to come, if he were not to have come, he would have still gotten, you know, like backlash.
El Paso's population is more than 80% Latino. But Anshondo's comments are a reminder that the Latino population is not politically monolithic. El Paso County has a Democratic judge, but the city has a Republican mayor. In an interview he gave to NPR last year, Anshondo said his family was conservative Republican. So is El Paso and Gloria Selig Pena.
I know my president. I know him very well. And I know he's a little bit crazy sometimes.
Pena taught high school math in El Paso for close to 40 years. After the shooting, she was furious when Democrats like Congresswoman Veronica Escobar blamed Trump.
This was an act of horror, a demonic act. You don't point fingers. And these people were still lying on the ground. And my representatives were talking about how Donald Trump was the reason that this happened. And that's just a lie.
The attack did, though, provoke some discussion in El Paso's Republican community. Efren Ortega is an Air Force staff sergeant at Fort Bliss.
It caused conversation about how things like this shooting and since, you know, he was a Trump supporter, how it might affect the way the city will vote.
People like Angel Ulloa certainly hope so. Ulloa coordinates the local chapter of JOLT, a Latino progressive organization. She says the shooting changed the minds of her older, more conservative relatives. Afterwards, she says they
kind of became aware that what he was putting into media was could be traced, the shooting could be traced back to what Trump was saying about us.
El Paso is less divisive in its politics than other parts of Texas, according to Jose Villalobos, who teaches political science at the University of Texas at El Paso.
This is not a city where you had people who are in an incredibly ugly way attacking each other over an issue like gun rights. And after the attack, there were very respectful debates and very, I think, meaningful conversations that were being had, even among those who were on very far sides of the political spectrum.
As for Tito Anshondo, whose family is conservative, he told me now he'd call himself politically neutral. More than the shooting, he points to the deaths of George Floyd and Vanessa Guillen as influencing his views.
Our nation is divided, I would say, 50-50, and it's half conservatism and half liberalism. You know, there seems to be no solutions to problems. It's just bickering back and forth.
He has yet to choose how he'll vote in the 2020 election. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Let's find out what they're talking about on social media today. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, joins us. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, as we've been discussing, it is the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart, that hate crime against Hispanics, which left 23 people dead. It's a grim milestone, a difficult, painful thing to process even 1 year later. Via Twitter, Tony Venegas says that when he thinks of El Paso, he thinks of the kindness of people. You can come from anywhere, all across the country or the world, and people are always so welcoming of others. I think a remark, David, that really strikes at the heart of the shock that this incident prompted. On our Facebook page, lifelong El Paso resident Jaime Solorza says, "The pain is still here. The anger is still here. We are a loving community, but don't confuse our kindness for weakness. We are El Paso strong." Just some of the reactions we're seeing out there today on social media, David. I'll be back with more reactions on this story and other ones from social later in the show.
Yes, we would love to hear from you, Texas. Let us know what's on your news radar right now. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he's going to be joining us with more of the Talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so. There's a whole lot more of the Texas Standard just ahead.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Midland school officials decided to change the name of the city's famous Robert E. Lee High School. This, as school districts across the country are re-examining campuses named after Confederate generals. The decision in Midland sparked celebration and rage. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports the battle may not be over.
It was a matter-of-fact ending to a four-hour meeting and what some call one of the most divisive issues in Midland's history.
It's 6-1. Mr. Murray voted against. All the other board members voted in favor of it.
That was the Midland Independent School District's Board of Trustees voting to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School. The school opened up in 1961 before Midland desegregated, and the name caused decades of tension. But then the name Lee became associated with the school's football fame, especially after the Lee Rebels took home three state championships in the 90s and early aughts. Dixie played at football games until the school dropped its unofficial fight song 3 years ago, after Unite the Right, a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, erupted in violence. At that time, there was also a campaign to change the school's name, but it failed. Then, George Floyd was killed, and the effort was revived. This protest in Midland had a profound impact on Courtney Ratliff, a Lee High School alumni who also played in the school's band.
that I just felt like we need to start talking about this, and we need to start talking very seriously about this.
So Ratliff started a debate on Lehigh's Facebook alumni group, which exploded. Then he began an online petition to change the name.
You fight for your name. You fight for the name of that school. And then when I really stopped and thought about it, was that name of that school really fighting for me?
The petition gained supporters like Avery Shaw, a recent graduate from Lee.
I don't understand why they would name something after a man who was racist, who was a slave owner, who tried to keep my ancestors from being free.
Over 10,000 people ended up signing Ratliff's petition, but thousands of others signed counter-petitions to keep Lee as the school's name.
The man was served his nation to the best of his ability. It's just not right what's going on.
That's Midland County Judge Terry Johnson.
My uncle was a proud rebel who graduated in the first graduating class. My children were proud rebels. My grandkids. Now that identity is being taken away.
Johnson's frustration was echoed by Brian Murray, the one school board member who opposed the change. He said many Lee alum felt this decision would
destroy their legacy and future dreams of elementary students to junior high students to freshman high school boys that have dreamed of one day wearing LEE on their helmets.
His argument didn't convince Rick Davis, the school board president.
I was flooded with emails, and so once I was convinced that it really was a locally driven movement with Lee people supporting it, then I became convinced that it's their high school, they're wanting a change, and I couldn't agree more that it needs to be changed.
Courtney Ratliff watched the vote from the hospital as he battled COVID-19. He said he cried at the final tally.
It was just like this weight had been lifted off of my shoulders and off of the shoulders of Black Midland.
But the fight's not over. A committee will come up with potential names to present to the school board by October. Some are trying to salvage the school's brand by formulating an acronym that spells out Lee, or finding another historical figure whose name is Lee. I'm Mitch Borden in Midland.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, it's been a little over a week since the first Atlantic hurricane of 2020 hit the Texas Gulf Coast. Hannah made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane on Padre Island on July 25th, an earlier than normal start to Texas's hurricane season. Here to give us a look at the storm's impact on the energy industry and what may be to come, Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Well, I guess we're well into hurricane season now. Has this been a particularly active one, and is it having much impact on the energy sector from what you can tell?
Actually, David, the pace of named storms so far this Atlantic hurricane season is actually at a record. We're currently surpassing the previous record seen in 2005, lest we all forget that was the year of Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. We've had 9 named storms already, when the average for an entire season, which typically peaks in September, is around 12. We've currently got this hurricane. It's working its way up the eastern seaboard there. I know not necessarily concerned for Texas, but the Atlantic hurricane season is so strong. That's the one thing to bear in mind, is that we're still over a month away from the peak, and we should actually really start to see hurricane activity ratcheting up in the back half of August as we approach the peak that is around about September 10th.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you can't keep your eye off of these developments, especially as they are to our east, because as we've seen these spaghetti projections quite often, they begin to look like they are heading into the Gulf and then turn up, as this one did, along the east coast. What does all this mean for Texas, where we have all these energy hubs that fall into a hurricane's path? Did the recent hurricane, Hannah, have any significant impact on Texas oil production, for example?
No, she didn't. But making landfall there, as you said, at Padre Island, Corpus Christi there is actually the largest exporting hub of the US. And so we actually saw near record exports just ahead of that hurricane making landfall there. And so it could have been extremely impactful because they export about up to 2 million barrels a day out of Corpus there. So as the US becomes more of an exporter, this becomes a bigger threat to some of those exporting hubs.
And we should, of course, clarify that when we say biggest exporting port, we're talking about the export of energy. There's also a large LNG plant down there, too, right?
Yeah, LPG as well. So there's all manner of different products and that being exported. So this is why it's so different to maybe a decade ago, because there's two ways that tropical activity impacts energy in the U.S. Gulf. One is the shuttering of refineries and of oil and gas production, as you mentioned there. But the other impact is the disruption to waterborne flows, so vessels coming in and out. So while the refining activity in the U.S. Gulf is pretty similar, well, actually, it's more prevalent now than it was a decade ago. There has been this sort of baton change between where there's less crude being imported, but because of higher production in the US now and in the Texas region there, exports are much more prevalent, as you mentioned, not just oil, but gasoline, diesel, LPG, LNG, all these things. And so they can be impacted by the storms and not just the production side of things.
And sometimes even the expectations have an effect on the bottom line. I mean, if you start to see a season where you have a lot of named storms, that factors into how much people are willing to risk on obtaining energy from Texas.
Well, yeah, in theory, it also has a varying effect as well from the perspective that if it's going to hit the refineries, then it's going to cause our gasoline price to increase. But if you see the storm coming in and it misses energy infrastructure, it's going to have a cooling impact on temperatures, which means that natural gas prices, in theory, should be lower.
We're talking about the impact of hurricanes on the energy sector in Texas. Matt Smith is keeping an eye on things as Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. He'll keep us posted. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, sir.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Today marks 1 year since a gunman murdered 23 people and wounded dozens more at an El Paso Walmart. KTEP's Angela Kachurga reports the memorial last night was closed to the public as a precaution for COVID-19.
Leonardo Campos Jr. and Maribel Hernandez Loya.
Maria Eugenia Lagareta Ross.
The interfaith remembrance ceremony included a reading of the names of the 23 victims killed in the attack. Masks and social distancing were among the COVID-19 precautions. The event was limited to a few officials, religious leaders, and relatives of those killed in the mass shooting at a Walmart. Martha Santiesteban's 90-year-old father, Luis Juarez, was the oldest victim. He died trying to protect his wife.
She was saying that the shots were so loud. She said, I'm so scared. And he grabbed her head and he said, don't be afraid. No tengas miedo. Those were his final words to her.
His wife, Martha, survived the attack. The event also included a reading of the names of dozens of people wounded and a groundbreaking for a healing garden planted in honor of the victims. In El Paso, I'm Angela Kochariga.
A West Texas Republican is seeking a recount in the primary election he narrowly lost to succeed GOP Congressman Will Hurd, who's not seeking another term. Raul Reyes said Friday his July 14th runoff against Tony Gonzalez was too close to accept the results. The Texas Secretary of State's office shows Gonzalez won by just 7 votes for the 23rd congressional district, which stretches from San Antonio to the El Paso area. And as the coronavirus surge continues in Texas, people in the funeral industry are struggling to keep up. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports.
Nationwide, revenue in the casket manufacturing industry has increased by 5% this year, according to industry research firm Ibis World. Kyle Goldstein owns Lone Star Casket, a Houston-area casket wholesale business. He says normally his best sales numbers happen in the winter, but he's broken all his records in the past 2 months.
If I encounter anybody that does not believe in the severity of this pandemic, I can take you to a funeral home and show you how serious it is. It is no exaggeration that the bodies are, in a literal sense, stacking up.
Ibis World says the demand is overwhelming many funeral-related businesses in urban areas. Goldstein says he prepared for the expected rise in deaths early on by increasing his inventory. I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. For some folks, the pandemic has meant more regular visits from delivery drivers. A lot of the stuff you might have gone out to get these days, you might just get shipped right to the front door just to be safe. Lately, some people have been getting items they didn't order, like seeds. Across the country, small packets of seeds have been showing up in people's mailboxes and at their front doors unsolicited. Where they came from, not to mention who sent them and why, is unclear. But Kevin Ong is trying to get to the bottom of it. He's the director of the Texas Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab at Texas A&M University. Professor Ong, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about why these packets are concerning. They're just seeds, right? So what is it that officials are worried about?
So at this time, while it is just seeds, the fact of the matter is when it initially occurred, we did not know what type of seed this was. So the USDA and Texas Department of Ag was very concerned that it might be weeds or perhaps some even noxious weeds or seeds that could probably harbor pathogens that could be detrimental to our agriculture and our natural resources. But as of July 31st, there had been additional information coming out from the USDA, and they have identified some of those seeds, and they're all different types. So they would group it as fruit seeds, vegetable seeds, herbs, and some of those that had been named is like mustard, kale, cabbage, rosemary, mint, and morning glory.
Very interesting. Of course, it raises the question, what's going on here? Is this some kind of scam or a joke? Or why would someone send seed packets in the mail without any further identification of what they are or why people are getting these?
So at this time, the USDA issued a statement that they don't have any additional information that other than to suggest that it might be a brushing scam. So apparently a brushing scam is one where a vendor might send out packages to a bunch of registered buyers, online buyers, so that they can put a favorable review on the selling site. The vendor or supposed vendor might be able to take that email address and fraudulently insert a favorable review. And I believe that was the warning that was put out by USDA as well on the July 31st memo, asking folks that if you do purchase online stuff and you did receive one of those seed packages, you might want to check your account to make sure it was not access or hack or even change your password.
Obviously, it's peculiar to get a bag of unsolicited seeds in the mail, but how dangerous is it? What are the risks here? You mentioned the possibility of pathogens.
So ecologically speaking, the first risk would involve a potential what we call invasive species. There is a potential that those seeds could germinate, could take hold, and create problems for farmers, create problems for homeowners in terms of having to deal extra with some weeds that may be a little bit more resistant to some of the herbicides or products that we might have.
Do you think that there should be greater restrictions on sending seeds through the mail or through delivery services like these?
Well, thank you for the question. And in fact, the one unit that is taking charge of the investigation in the USDA is the Smuggling Interdiction and Trade Compliance Team. Because with the seed trade, there are some seeds that are regulated. So there needs to be permit, there needs to be the right paperwork in order for international trade of those seeds. So this is, you know, one of those highlights where some of our checks and measures is probably not up to snuff.
Bottom line, of course, if you get mystery seeds sent to you, don't plant them, I assume.
Absolutely. So the main message we want folks to understand is if you do get one of this packet, number one, do not plant those seeds. And number two, don't just toss them away in the trash. Because even in tossing it away in the trash and having it take to a landfill, there is a possibility those seeds could escape and start growing. So what you would want to do is, if you get one of this packet, put it in a Ziploc bag, email, call Texas Department of Ag or USDA. They will provide some instruction as to what to do. Right now, I know in Texas, there is a little of a backlog. And so if you had reported, thank you. And be patient. Someone will get back with you.
Kevin Ong is the director of the Texas Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab at Texas A&M University. Details over at texasstandard.org. Professor, thanks again.
You're most welcome.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
My name is Nezi Shabazz, and I'm a resident of Keller, Texas. And I'm a senior. I'm 72 years old, and with shelter in place, I get bored and just start creating masks and different things like that. I do make some of my clothes, and so I had some scrap fabric left over from some of them. I had a long sleeve blouse, made it 3/4 length sleeves, and took the rest of it and made a mask. Because time I pay my rent, I got $9 left over. So that's not very much to do anything with. And so you just take what you have and you just repurpose it. And that's basically what I did. I had a big white flower, silk flower. So I took the leaves and kind of put it where the earlobes are. And I hand sewed it all the way around to where it looks like a big mum or something. It's quite massive. But it keeps coronavirus out, okay? And every time I do go out, say for instance to Kroger's or Tom Thumb's or the dollar store, and I love Lowe's, I'll have a mask on and people will stop me. Four or five people will stop me and say, oh my God, where'd you get that mask? So it gets attention. I didn't do it for attention. I just figured out, well, hey, if I have to wear a mask, it might as well match what I have on. That was my purpose. I have something called osteofibrosis, to where my knees do not bend. But the thing is, I would not let this disability steal my joy, because I'm still alive and there's millions of people in the world that wish they could walk as good as I can. I can walk. A little funny, but I do walk. So I don't look at what doesn't work. I look at what does work. And I can stand there and I can make something small, like masks and things like that. Just a little sewing. I don't do near as much as I used to. And I'm a sixth generation seamstress. I could think about all the things that hurt me. I could think about the person that bludgeoned me with a hammer and left me for dead. I could think about, I suffered police brutality too in the early 60s. You know, I had a grandmother that was murdered. But the thing is, I don't dwell on that. You got to love and forgive everybody, no matter what they did, and keep going on. Because love is the most powerful thing that we have. And that's what the whole world needs right now. Each and every one of us is to love unconditionally. Well, I tell you, it was a plum pleasing pleasure to talk to you. I'm Nezi Shabazz, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Back to our top story, we mentioned that it was 1 year ago today that prosecutors say a then 21-year-old white man, Patrick Cruzius, opened fire at a Walmart in El Paso after having posted a racist screed against Latinos online, driving 600 miles from his home in North Texas to commit mass murder. Many believe the suspect developed his extremist views online. Kate Yare's Hadi Mawagde visited the county where the suspect grew up to explore what kind of influence his environment may have had.
White children and their parents chanted in opposition in this 1971 protest against busing in downtown Dallas. Families like these fled the city when schools integrated and were the beginnings of Collin County's growth.
Since the federal courts had ruled that the suburbs did not have to bus because they were outside of the city limits, the suburbs became very attractive to people who did not want their kids going to integrated schools.
That's Bob Fairbanks, a historian at the University of Texas, Arlington. Nearly 50 years after that protest, Collin County is one of the fastest growing communities in the U.S. But now, it's not white families heading to the suburban oasis. It's people of color and immigrants moving here for schools and for jobs at places like Toyota and Texas Instruments. At a strip mall in Plano, not too far away from where Patrick Crucis attended high school, this Middle Eastern grocery is next door to an Indian hair salon and a Taiwanese boba shop. Across the street, South Asians are working at an auto body shop. Patrick Crucius lived in a two-story brick house with a manicured lawn, just like the other houses on this street in the city of Allen. In just the two decades he was growing up here, the county's white population dropped from nearly 80% to 55%. And many white people saw that as a threat.
You know, there's been an assertion on the part of white suburbanites that those spaces should remain white, right? That they should not transition along with the rest of the nation.
Historian Max Crockmall studies race politics at Texas Christian University. He says white people have developed a defensive localism about their communities and will fight to protect their privileged position.
But they often do so in language that appears to be race neutral, even though I would say that, you know, race is still at the heart of all of it.
In 2014, when Crucius was 15 years old, county commissioners held a standing room only town hall to discuss whether to house immigrant children from Central and Latin America. Here's one commissioner speaking with the local Fox affiliate at the time.
We've heard reports that a lot of these children have various communicable diseases that are fairly common in their country of origin that are very uncommon here.
In 2015, when an Islamic group wanted to buy land for a cemetery, white residents lashed out with verbal attacks against the group's religion. Local resident Diane Puco told KERA that she was against the cemetery, adding it had nothing to do with religion.
We don't like the fact that we seem to be portrayed in the media as radicals against Islam. We don't want to be dumped on. We want to have say over how our community grows.
In that same year, in another city in Collin County, a state representative introduced an anti-Sharia bill. It failed, but it was revived and passed in 2017. Soon after, a local hate group stood outside Islamic centers in the area, holding guns and accusing worshippers of having ties to Middle Eastern groups. Chris Vasquez, like Patrick Crucius, was born and raised in Collin County. He says he and his family regularly endured racist acts and words like this.
You know, my mother is someone who is invading, my family being an invaders. They don't see us as human. That's why they use words like illegal aliens. That's not a they know what they're saying when they say that.
Vasquez can recall as a young child a grocery store manager confronting him and his mother for speaking Spanish with an employee.
That encounter in particular really affected the way I saw things and really still affects me today because I had that encounter and was fearful of using, you know, the language my mother spoke.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has identified at least 10 different hate groups in the North Texas region, including two white nationalist groups from Collin County. Though that doesn't make Collin County all that unique.
Collin County has all the characteristics that could lead to trouble, but it's no different in many ways from anywhere else in the country where we don't know the history of racism and white supremacy where we live, and we need to start there.
Selena Brody is also a native Collin County resident. She's a social psychology professor who studies the origins of prejudice. And she says racism and xenophobia aren't necessarily learned in the home.
You get that message loud and clear from the context environment around you. But the power of the messaging, particularly from respected authorities, are shaping the way that we talk about each other.
Which Professor Brody says can be very powerful. I'm Hadi Mawakdi in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12. Offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Democrats running for Congress in Texas are seeing some of the biggest fundraising dollars in years compared to their Republican opponents. That's according to new campaign finance analysis from the Texas Tribune. The headline, for the first time in years, Texas Democrats running for the U.S. House have more campaign cash than Republicans, a $7.5 million advantage in House races. But while those campaign coffers may be more full than in years past, how much does it really matter for Texas Democrats come November? Kevin Banda is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech University, with some of his expertise focusing on political campaigning. Professor Banda, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
How big of an anomaly is this?
Well, I suppose it's strange in the context of contemporary Texas politics. But on the other hand, it's also, 2020 is shaping up to be a bad year for the Republican Party. And in contexts like that, it's not surprising that the weaker party in a state might get an influx of cash.
So that's why you think Democratic statewide candidates in Texas are seeing these larger than normal hauls? It's something that's happening on a sort of macro level across the country, or is there something going on in Texas in particular?
Well, it's both, right? So most of what goes on in elections in terms of determining outcomes is structure. And right now that structure is that the economy is bad. People are upset at the incumbent Republican president. And what that means is that people are likely to punish the Republican Party by either staying home if they're normal Republican voters, or by showing up at higher rates if they're Democrats, or by switching, probably temporarily. So that makes states like Texas more competitive in that people are more willing to donate money. Democrats are more likely to show up to vote. And probably better Democratic candidates are more willing to run for office.
I think when some listeners hear about these dollars coming in, that it's viewed as a kind of proxy for what actually happens on Election Day. How closely do dollars and votes actually track?
So they don't. So just as a quick example, Michael Bloomberg just spent $1 jillion in the Democratic presidential primary, and that got him essentially nothing other than a bunch of attention, I guess. So dollars don't buy votes. But if parties or candidates are able to raise a lot of money, that's usually an indication that their opponent is weak, or at least the donors think that they're weak, and thus political elites think that they're weak. So when the challenger has a lot of money on hand, that's a bad sign for the incumbent, even though the incumbent is still more likely to win.
Historically, of course, when it comes to money in Texas, Texas has been a firmly red state, although we've been seeing several polls showing a close race between Biden and Trump here. Do you think Democrats are working to create some coattails here, and that's part of what we're seeing?
Yeah, so if the presidential race is going to be close, and at least so far it appears that it's going to be close, that can create some opportunities for Democrats to take state legislative seats, perhaps at the local level as well. Maybe they'll take some mayoral elections or things like that. So there's an incentive there to recruit the best candidates as possible and to convince donors to contribute as much as possible. The other thing I want to note is that Texas is sort of a weird state in that, you know, people think of it as being this, you know, it's as red a state as California is blue. And that's not quite true. Turnout in Texas is really bad relative to other states. And the kinds of people who tend not to vote in Texas are also the kinds of people who are likely to be Democrats, or at least be Democratic voters. So if the party or candidates can convince those people to turn out more in the context of this year, those races can be a lot more competitive than they normally would be.
We've been talking with Kevin Banda. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech University. Professor Banda, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, we promised you he'd be back, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, that is. Hi there, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to be back with you. Good to have you back in the host chair.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, as we've been hearing, it's a difficult day for many. The one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart by an outsider who traveled to the borderlands intent on killing people with Mexican ancestry. You know, El Paso is my hometown, and it's also the hometown of another one of the reporters we hear on this show, Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales. And Carlos has done something somewhat remarkable on Twitter. He's put up this question at a call-out to his El Paso family. How do you describe our hometown? What makes it special for you? Just a few of the responses here that are resonating. One Twitter user, Biomedia Lab, says humble, kind, and generous. And Anna Rausch says, what makes El Paso strong is its diversity and its tolerance for others who may be different than you. I have always felt safe here. And I think, you know, I mentioned this earlier, and I think this really strikes at the heart of, the terrible carnage in El Paso, is the fact that it always has felt a very familial sense down there and a very welcoming sense. And the fact that it was perforated by an outsider, by someone who traveled all the way from North Texas to perform these heinous acts. So obviously...
Something that a lot of people have not missed over the past several years is how El Paso has become a kind of a place where the Trump administration has tested out some of its policies, more controversial policies as it relates to immigration in particular. And so I think a lot of eyes have been on El Paso in large part because of the sense of community and the diversity of that border city. So
decided to sell.
Our thoughts are with you, El Paso, on this important day.
Definitely so. Well, you know, shifting gears, we just heard about how House Democrat hopefuls are actually outraising Republicans heading into November. Here's a salient bit of news that just came across my Twitter feed. In a post on Medium, the blogging site, former President Barack Obama just endorsed a huge slate of Democratic candidates, including 19 Texas Democrats running for the U.S. House in November. Former President Obama tweeting, I'm proud to endorse this diverse and hopeful collection of thoughtful, empathetic, and highly qualified Democrats. If you're in one of their districts or states, make sure you vote for them. And if you can, vote early by mail or in person. One representative response here from one of the Democrats that was endorsed by the former president, James Talarico. He says, I just got endorsed by Barack Obama. Is this what peaking feels like? So again, here as we head into what will surely be a hotly contested election in November, first big slate of endorsements from former President Obama, obviously one of the Democrats' biggest leaders here going into the fall.
Yes, he had been rather quiet on the campaign front for some time, and people were wondering when or if he was actually going to start putting on his boxing gloves, as it were, politically speaking, at least. And it seems that he has, and it's got a lot of folks in Texas talking. We'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us at Texas Standard. You can join us online anytime 24/7 to keep up with all the news in the Lone Star State at texasstandard.org. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we hope you'll join us again tomorrow. We'll be here, and we hope you will too.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.